Okay, so I'm going to begin with the Elitsa-Weidman bomb problem. So some of you may have heard of this. I'm sure that Barak has, because he worked with Weidman. For those of you that haven't, it's a fun problem that you can use to entertain your friends down the pub. So here's the problem. We have a factory. My drawing of a factory. And this factory produces bombs. Here's a bomb. Okay, the bomb has a handle. And the bomb also has a trigger here. Which is so incredibly sensitive that if a single particle of any kind whatsoever, photon or electron, any kind of particle whatsoever, hits this trigger, the bomb will explode. The only problem is that this factory, their manufacturing process, isn't completely perfect. And so sometimes what comes out of the factory looks like this. The trigger is missing. So we have these two kinds of bombs. And just so we have a way of referring to them, we'll call this one the good bomb. Because it works. And this one, the bad bomb. Because the trigger is missing. So the question is it possible to run some kind of test to find out if you have a good bomb or a bad bomb? Now, it doesn't matter if you explode a few bombs in the process of running this test, but what you want to have is at the end of the test that you've managed to establish that some subset of the bombs are good bombs, and yet you haven't exploded them. Now, remember, if any particle of any kind whatsoever hits the trigger, the bomb will explode. So it seems like this is impossible, because the only way to test to see if the bomb is good or bad is to send some light or something, some particles onto this trigger. And yet if you do that, the bomb will explode. So this is the Elitsa-Weidman bomb problem. And we'll come back to it in a little bit. So let me just say a few things about this course. It's going to consist of three parts. So in the first part, I'm going to talk about novel quantum effects. So it's interesting, if you want to really understand quantum theory, it's worth looking at lots of different examples that show you something interesting about the theory. So there's lots of novel quantum effects, and I want to discuss just a few of them, in this first part. The second part is about concepts and interpretation. So this is really what everyone thinks quantum foundations is about. So concepts are things like Bell-type non-locality, contextuality. Interpretations are things like the different interpretations that are available, the many-world interpretation, the De Broglie-Bohm interpretation, the Copenhagen interpretation. and many more. And then the third part is about the general structural questions in quantum theory. So in particular, I'm interested in reconstructing and reformulating. So by reconstructing quantum theory, what I mean is trying to find simple postulates from which you can derive the full structure of quantum theory, or maybe just some interesting part of the structure of quantum theory. A good analogy is to think about special relativity. So even before Einstein did his work in 1905, they already had the Lorentz transformations. And Einstein found some simple axioms that you could use to obtain the Lorentz transformations. So it would be interesting to do something similar in the case of quantum theory. So if you think about the usual abstract axioms of quantum theory as being akin to the Lorentz transformations, then it would be nice to find some axioms for quantum theory that were in some way akin to Einstein's axioms for special relativity. And then also it's interesting to look at different reformulations of quantum theory because they can teach you something different about the theory. So there's the work by Aharonov et al. Giving a time-symmetric formulation of quantum theory. There's various other reformulations of quantum theory that I'll talk about. So one thing I want to say at the beginning is I'm going to try and make this course clear, so you should, in principle, be able to follow everything I say. If something isn't clear, please interrupt. I welcome interruptions. Okay. So I'm going to start with interferometers. This is an interesting kind of physical system. It's good for providing insight into quantum theory. You can set up the sort of basic theory very simply, do calculations. And some of the tutorials and homework will use this. So first of all, let's look at one particle interference. So imagine we have a source. What I'm going to do is I'm going to describe each of the component parts of an interferometer and say how you describe them mathematically. So here's a source. It emits a particle. We'll say that the particle is in the state S. This is a lowercase s, and that simply is also the label I'm going to use for the path associated with the particle. So if you press this button, then a particle of some type comes out of this source. You describe it in that way. Next thing is a path length. Imagine the particle travels along a path of length L. Then we'll say, this is path A, then we'll say that the state evolves like this. Here I'm going to treat monochromatic or single, you know, a single frequency or wavelength situation. This is a single mode approach. You can very simply do multi-mode calculations as well, but it adds some complication and all the physical insights, we can see them here at this single mode level. So if a particle travels along a certain path length, say inside an interferometer, then you have to multiply it by a phase, which is determined by the length of the path. Another thing you can do is allow the particle to travel through a phase shifter. So for example, in the case of photons, a piece of glass will impart a phase. And then you have that evolution. Another thing is a mirror. So I'm just going to refer to this path by the same name before and after the mirror. In some treatments, people will change the name from A to, say, B. And then I'm going to use the, well, this is almost a convention of putting a phase shift of I after a mirror. It doesn't really matter what number you put here. It could just be like that. But I've always found it convenient to put an I there. And the mirror, of course, could be the other way around. You could have a mirror like this as well. Or any other angle. In the case, I mean, it is possible, in principle, it is possible to actually find out what the phase is by doing careful experiments. But then you could always just change the path length slightly, you know, by something of the order of a wavelength after the mirror to make sure that this actually was the phase shift after the mirror. So it really doesn't matter what number you put there.
And all these things you're stating, they're just rules we've got that produce the right results.
Exactly, yeah. They all work pretty well. Yeah. So to do real experiments, you want to go to multimode treatments. But these give you the right results pretty much. And then.
Right, I was just wondering, like, we're not deriving these.
No, I'm just giving you this. This is a set of prescriptions I'm giving you. They're consistent with quantum theory. This much is true. So, now we come to a more interesting object, which is a beam splitter. Maybe I should. I think there's a problem with this. Let's see what happens.
Can you use the manual?
Yeah, I'll do that. Okay. So next is the beam splitter. So this looks like this. This is so in the case of photons, a beam splitter would be a piece of glass which has got some silvering on it, so sort of a partial mirror. So so if you send a particle in this way, there's some probability that it will be transmitted and some probability it will be reflected. Then we're going to give each of these paths a name. And then it has, depending on how much silvering you put on this, you have a certain transmissivity and reflectivity. These two numbers have to add up to one. Actually, that's not necessarily true. You can have some absorption in the mirror as well, in the beam splitter. in which case these add up to a number less than 1, but we're going to assume that they add up to 1. And now, one way to write down this transformation is the following. So if you have a particle coming in from this side, it has some chance of being transmitted and some chance of being reflected. And if we have a particle coming in from the bottom, the same is true. Okay. Any questions? So let me make a few comments. So this transformation is unitary. So you can check, in particular, you can check the following things are true. Well, sorry. I should maybe make one thing clear. So this by definition is equal to 1. But then if you substitute these expressions in here, then this will evolve to a certain expression that you can calculate. And assuming that the overlaps of each of these things, so we assume and so on, because you can distinguish those cases. So if you substitute that in here and use, and we also assume, of course, as well as so if you substitute these in here, you'll see that afterwards you also get 1. So the overlap of this with itself is 1. You can see that because you just get you get t plus r, and that's equal to 1. And you can also check that these things are orthogonal. These things afterwards are orthogonal. So if you take the overlap of this with this, you get 0. So this arrow just means that you substitute in these expressions and then calculate. And this is important. So this means that this this transformation is unitary. It's interesting, if you look at the literature, every now and then someone will make a mistake and use a non-unitary transformation here on a beam splitter. And then they'll start getting amazing things happening, like they'll be able to signal faster than light do other terrible things. Get very excited and start asking for the Nobel Prize. It's essential that this transformation is unitary.
So would this not work if there was some absorption in the mirror?
So there's different ways to treat it then. Maybe the right way to treat it if you have absorption is to go over to density matrices and do a proper mixed state treatment. You know, you did density matrices with, and then you can use completely positive maps, which I think you would have covered as well. So that would be the way to treat it then. And so then the transformations wouldn't be unitary, but they would be completely positive maps, and so you wouldn't get any crazy things happening. Yeah.
How does going to density matrices deal with absorption? Is it absorption when you have, like, you know, you're talking about a photon coming in and going just being absorbed by the glass?
Yeah, how does what do?
How does density matrices?
The trace would go to a number less than, the trace of the density matrix would go to a number less than 1. I mean, you could also do it in this case, and then, one way to do it is the following. You can say, well, you can imagine actually the state of this piece of glass changes when it absorbs a photon. So then you just have an extra term over here and here. And then you can stick within the pure state framework if you want. Or you could allow the density matrix to be subnormalized. And that would be a way of treating it as well. So a completely positive map doesn't have to be trace preserving. It can be trace decreasing. Okay. Right. Oh, and so just to refer back to the mirror, the reason I use this I is because it's consistent with this just in the limit as t goes to 0 and r goes to 1. So that's one reason to use that particular convention. Okay, just a few more components. So this is really like Lego. You know, if you have all these different pieces, then you can put them together and build interferometers and see what you get. Okay. So another important component is detector. So this looks like this. So we have path D, a detector, D. I'm just going to use the same letter to describe the detector as I use for the path. And then the initial state is, well, the particle is coming along. The detector is in the ready state. So I denote that by a 0. And then it goes to the excited state where it's detected the particle. And also you can see the particle has been absorbed in this case. Another way of modeling a detector is to imagine that the particle passes through the detector. And then afterwards, you still have the particle, which you can use to do something else with. So the means the detector clicks. Okay. So I'll go for a few examples now using this this Lego. Yep.
The second example, the state of the particle doesn't change when it goes through the detector.
Yeah, in this case, we're just imagining the particle state is unchanged, which is, I mean, this the transformation I'm describing here is unitary. Now, if you really want to do this in a laboratory, it's quite difficult, but it's theoretically possible.
Isn't it like more realistic that the state of the particle
would change a bit? Yeah, that's more realistic. But just to sort of, if we're interested in Gedanken experiments, then we can consider the case where it doesn't. Yeah. I mean. Yeah, a realistic. So first of all, in a realistic case, it's actually really difficult to build detectors that allow the particles to pass through. And certainly, most likely, they would just slightly change the particle. But it's possible that they don't. And really, the test for possibility in quantum theory is just, can I write, well, if we're looking at pure state quantum theory, the test for possibility is, can I write down a unitary transformation that includes the given transformation? And we can. This is there's nothing non-unitary about this. But you're right that in practice that there would be some slight change to the particle in the output. Okay. So let's just do a few examples. So first of all, zero example. So all that happens then is you have particle impinges on a detector, and the particle is absorbed. Okay. Let's do a more interesting example. So you just have a particle, it hits a beam splitter, then it goes in each path through a phase shifter, and then onto a detector. Okay, so not much is happening here, but still it's quite interesting. Let me just go through the maths. So initially, you have the particle coming in along path A, and both of these particles are sitting, waiting in the ready state. Now we have to substitute in here the appropriate formula for a beam splitter. So and I can also take the phase in as well. So in path B, you get a R, square root of R, I, phase shift. And in path C, you get square root of T, and a phase shift. Straightforward. Now we can just let this particle hit the detectors. Now we can look at, we can use this to calculate the probabilities for different situations. So probability of getting detector B fire, detector C not fire is this. Probability of getting B not fire and C fire is just T. Probability of getting no detector fire is 0. The probability that both detectors fire is also 0. So a few things to notice. It's a very simple experiment. You get an anticorrelation. Either a particle is detected here or a particle is detected here. And there's no dependence on these phases. I think by itself, it doesn't look very interesting. But when you start to look at this experiment in the context of the fact that you also have interference, then it becomes more interesting. And so one way to see that is even if you just try to give a wave explanation for this. So imagine if a wave comes along, then the wave will be split into equal parts. And then the most obvious model would be that the probability of detection is just proportional to the wave. So you'd have some probability here for detection and some here. And certainly, you'd expect then to get the particle being detected in two places sometimes. So even this simple experiment rules out kind of an obvious, the most obvious wave picture that you might try to apply to this. Am I doing something wrong? Maybe I'm just not pressing the button hard enough or too soft. Okay. So a second example. Well, now we come to the interferometer. So we have a particle comes in. It splits at a first beam splitter, which has this R and T, passes through a phase shifter in each path. Then it arrives at a second beam splitter, which can have in have different reflectivity and transmissivities. Then after that, there are detectors. If you do the calculation for this, I'm not going to do it here. I think it's in the first homework or something like this. You'll see that you get a dependence on both of these phase shifters. But let me just look at a few simple examples where we have specific values for the phase shifters. Just draw the mirrors in. Okay. So here's the simplest example we could imagine. So particle comes in. And we're going to imagine also that these are 50-50. So T and R are both equal to half. So it comes in. The reflected particle picks up a phase I because of the reflection at the beam splitter. It goes to that. And now we'll go past the two mirrors. Plus the two mirrors, then we end up with minus 1 over square root of 2 plus I over square root of 2 of u. The And now we want to take each of these separately through the beam splitter according to the equations over there. So U is transmitted into C and reflected into D. And meanwhile, V is reflected into C and transmitted into D. And if you just go through and look at this, then as long as I've done everything correctly, the D term should cancel. Does that work out? Yep. We get equals minus C. I didn't put the detectors in here into this calculation just to save the mess. But you can see that this means now, the C detector would always fire and the D detector never fires. One thing that's interesting here is that if you ask what's the probability of a particle arriving at this detector C if it goes just along the bottom path, well, it's a quarter because it has a half probability here and a half here. And then the probability of the particle arriving at this detector having gone along the top path is also a quarter. And yet, the two quarters, because of the way we do things in quantum theory, add up to one. There's a strange effect in some sense. More generally, you might say, well, if you have two processes, both have probability P, then in quantum theory, if you have constructor interference, you have to add the amplitudes and then take the square. And you get an effect which is twice as big as if you had just done the classical thing. Okay. Okay, what about if you put so here we had constructor interference in C, and destructor interference in D. Now we can imagine putting a phase shifter in here, where the phase shift is equal to pi. And if you do the calculation in this case, which I'm not going to do it out in full, you'll find that the initial input evolves. Sorry, that should be D, that should be C. And you find instead of getting the particle detected here, it's always detected here. Okay. And the same is true if instead you have the phase shifter of pi in the other arm. So in this case, D always fires. So now you can construct an argument that something goes along both paths. So remember in example one, the particle is either detected in B or D. So the obvious interpretation of that is to say, well, you have a ball, a little particle comes in, hits the beam splitter, 50% of the time it goes up, 50% of the time it goes across. The only trouble is that that model doesn't work here. So here's an argument to show that something goes along, in some sense, something goes along both paths. Imagine the model where a particle comes in and it only goes along one path. So it comes into this beam splitter, it could go up or down. Imagine it goes up, it arrives at this second mirror. Well, it hasn't experienced a phase shift, because there's no phase shifter in this path. And so it doesn't know if it's in the situation where there's a pi phase shifter in, so it should go into D, or whether it's in the situation I described before, where there's no phase shifter here, so then it should go to C. So this picture where a particle comes in and only goes in one direction cannot account for the fact that somehow the particle knows that it has to go, which detector it has to go in these examples I discussed. This is all very simple stuff, but it's nice just to rehearse these arguments. Any questions?
So from the first example, the first case before we put in the phase shifter,
yeah.
When you go through the mathematics, you see that you get C as the only outcome
yeah.
of the definite result, because the terms involving where you have both reflections and both transmittances sort of vanish.
Yeah, they cancel, yeah. Yeah.
Is there any particular reason, explanation behind why that happens?
Depends on what you mean by explanation. I mean, at one level, one can say, well, this is just the mathematical framework of quantum
yeah.
theory, and that's what it gives you. Or you could be saying, well, can you? And this is very basic. This follows from very basically from that framework. Or you could be saying, well, can you explain where that framework comes from? And then you have to wait to part three of the course, and I'll talk about some ideas in that direction. There's been a lot of work recently. In some ways, it's really just a mystery. I think it was Feynman who said this is the only mystery in quantum theory. I forget the exact quote, but this is the essential mystery in quantum theory, quantum interference. How am I doing? One thing you might try to do is look and see which way the particle is going. Incidentally, the notation I'm using with the C's and the D's actually comes from this original paper of Ritzer and Weidman. And the D, I think they chose D to indicate dark, because if you have zero path length, or you have no phase shifter in either path length, then this detector is dark. In this case, so now we have these detectors that allow the particle to pass, but register if the particle has gone through or not. And what you'll have now is that only one of these two detectors will fire, but you'll have no interference. If you put a phase shifter in as well, you'll have no interference. But there is an interesting experiment you can do where you can recover the interference if you perform a kind of quantum measurement on these detectors. So you can perform some measurement that erases the information stored in these detectors and recover the interference. And that's in the homework, I think. It's called the quantum eraser. Yeah, so in this case, I should mention what happens is you just get 50% the times the particle is detected here. and 50% of the time the particle is detected here. Okay, so let's come to the solution to the Elitzer-Weidman bomb problem. Do you have a question?
I just missed what U and V were.
Oh, okay. Did you get it now? Yeah, they're just these sorts of detectors that I had here.
Why would that change anything if the particle remained in the same state?
So if you look back at the calculation I did up here, this cancellation was essential to get destructive interference and constructive interference. But now the terms in here, you have to include the detectors in the calculation. And those detector states will stop the cancellation because they'll be different for the two paths. So finally, after all this, we can look at the solution to the Elitzer-Weidman bomb problem. So who had heard of the who had heard of the bomb problem before? So I know you had a number of you. Okay. So for those of you who hadn't heard and haven't guessed, the way you solve the problem is you build an interferometer. Like so. Now you take the bomb, holding it very carefully in a very dark room, and you place the bomb using the handle in such a way that if there is a trigger, the trigger will protrude into one of the two paths, the top path, see. Okay. So now, and then you leave the room and remotely by presumably some mechanism you've established, you press this button. Now various things can happen. So, in the case that the trigger is missing, this bomb will do nothing, and the particle will simply pass through and be detected here, always. Okay. On the other hand, if the trigger is present, then different things can happen. So one thing can happen is that the trigger can, that the bomb can explode. Okay. And that's fine, because remember I said you didn't have to save every single bomb, you just had to have some subset of bombs where you knew the trigger was good. Another thing that could happen is that this detector could fire. Well, that's okay because, if this detector fires, then you don't know if you have a trigger or not. But the final thing that can happen is that this detector fires, the dark detector. Now, we know that the only way this detector can fire is if the interference isn't happening. And this trigger will stop the interference. It would absorb any particles. So if this detector fires, then you know you have a good bomb. But you haven't exploded the bomb. Any questions?
Yeah. Well, technically, if D was still around after the bomb exploded, it still fire. It could still fire.
Sure, but you would also have the observation that the bomb had exploded. So you'd know that you had a good bomb, but it's no longer. Yeah. Sure.
But it still fire?
Well, what you could imagine is you could enclose this whole thing in some bomb-proof thing with just the hole big enough to allow the particle to go through. And so then the detector won't fire. It sort of takes a little getting used to this thing because it's hard to believe. Excuse me. It's sort of hard to believe that since the trigger was present, it means the particle must have gone along this way, in some sense. And so, what does it even know about the bomb? But if you go through the calculation, you can see that everything I said is correct. So one question is, well, what's the maximum proportion of bombs you can test like this? So the test I showed you, you would explode a certain fraction of bombs. Is it possible to do a test where you explode fewer bombs as a proportion of those that you successfully test? And what's the best you can do? And that's a tutorial question. Yeah. It turns out there's a way of doing it, which is very nice. So I have a few minutes left. So I'm just going to mention how you go about doing multi-particle interference in this kind of framework I showed you. So all you need then is just to include more particles. So one way of doing that is to have a device like this, source. And to make it interesting, so this is a two-particle source, but it has a certain property I'll mention. So the idea is that this source spits out particles so that they're back to back. So either the particles go out along the A paths, A and A prime, or they go out along the B paths, B and B prime. And so the state is like that. And so what you could do with this is you could build an interferometer where you complete both sides into an interferometer. So over here you have particle one, over here you have particle two. Okay. So this is a two-particle interferometer. So this has been built with using photons. And what you see is you get a violation of the Bell inequalities with this device. The interference now depends on the difference of the two phases. If you set things up appropriately, and you can violate the sum in this case.
exactly is a prime?
So I'm using, in this case here, I'm just using primes to indicate particle 2. Actually, a better notation would have been to use subscripts 1 and 2.
So the particle could go either, first particle is either A or B.
So particle, yeah, that's right. So particle 1 goes this way, and then particle 2 goes this way, or particle 1 goes this way, particle 2 goes this way. And that's the state, that's the state that we have here.
We also have a mechanism to ensure that we don't get A, B prime.
Sorry.
There is some mechanism to ensure that we don't have any A, B prime.
I mean, I'm just sort of describing a particular preparation, and there is a way of doing this. Using photons, there's something called parametric downconversion, which has the property that it spits out photons with well-correlated momentum. So there are ways of doing this. You can imagine in a sort of Gedanken experiment that the two particles sit here and then they decay, and then just by conservation of momentum, they would have to go in opposite directions. And then you could just have pinholes to allow the correlated, the particular cases you want out. But yeah, so this is certainly nothing about this. This is possible experimentally, and so this, I think this is an interesting. If you have some spare time on your hands, it's fun to go through this calculation. It's very similar to the calculation I described before for the interference phenomena, but now you have a sort of double interferometer, so it's just a bit more involved and consequently a bit more interesting. Okay, I have lots more, but I think I'll stop there and we'll carry on tomorrow.